Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolfe. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, maybe one that influenced their own work in a small way. And today, I'm very excited to have writer-director Jennifer Kent with me. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, how are you going, April?
Man, it's so great to see you.
Yeah,
and
likewise.
Such a humid LA day.
It's wunderbar.
Hey, for you out there who aren't as familiar with Jennifer's work, please let me give you a rundown of her entire life. Jen was born in Brisbane, Australia, where she's still at. The last of five children, which I cannot imagine. She graduated from the National Institute of Dramatic Art and has worked extensively in theater, film, and TV as an actor. But in 2002, Jen undertook a directing apprenticeship on Dogville, directed by Lars von Trier. I think a lot of our listeners know about
yes.
Dogville, which moved her further behind the camera and really began a kind of second career for you, essentially. From there, her award-winning short film Monster screened at over 50 international festivals, including Telluride Film Festival and Aspen Shorts Fest, where it won the Audience Award and the Ellen Award for Distinctive Achievement. Then, in 2010, Jennifer completed the script program at the Binger Film Lab in Amsterdam.
Amazing place.
We'll have to hear all about it. Where she developed her feature film, you guys might know it, it's called The Babadook. The Babadook screened at Sundance Film Festival in January 2014 to critical and audience acclaim and has won over 50 international and domestic awards, including the Australian Directors Guild Award for Best Director, the Australian Academy Award for Best Direction, Best Screenplay and Best Film, and the New York Critics Circle Awards for Best First Feature. It's also a gay icon film now.
Yes. Yes, it is. I'm proud to say. I have no idea why, but I'm happy about
it.
I'll take it.
This year now sees the release of her second feature called The Nightingale, a colonial revenge tale about a woman who loses everything and joins up with an Aboriginal tracker to find and inflict punishment on the men who wronged her. So Jen is also writing and will direct Tiptree,
yeah.
a TV limited series based on the extraordinary life and work of science fiction writer Alice B. Sheldon, extraordinary person.
Yes. I can't believe that now we have all the rights to the stories I need and to her biography, and it just sets my heart ablaze to think I can work on her stories and on her life, because she was just such an extraordinary human being, and not many people know about her.
Yeah.
So few people know who she is.
You get to bring her to people's lives.
Yeah.
And rediscover her books.
Yeah, so that's looking good at the moment.
Imperative Entertainment, along with Automatic, will executive produce that series, I believe.
Yeah.
And that's something that you're in production on right now? Or
no,
going into
just,
production?
I'm just, while I've been here in LA, I've been pitching my brains out to various network overlords.
Oh, wonderful.
And it's going well.
Yay!
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 Woo-hoo-hoo!
Cheers. We'll celebrate that. So, Jen, could you tell us a little bit about why you chose a film to talk about today, which is called The Innocents?
Yeah, as in two innocent or more, two or more innocent
two
people.
Or more
rather than
innocent.
The state of being.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Innocents. I feel it's a masterpiece. And I guess Guillermo del Toro approached me recently to work on a series with him and do a particular story. And he pitched me a ghost story, and which I, you know, it was an 8-minute sort of interaction. Then I said, sold.
Yeah.
It was a really great idea. But it made me think of, because there's so many, when I was asked, you know, pick your favourite genre film or your favourite horror film, I just really couldn't do that.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I was in
We were
the...
told by your reps, she cannot choose one, but she is going to.
I feel stress when asked to pick the best one. It's like anxiety inducing. But I remembered this film because I was in the ghost story zone.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it's a masterpiece in terms of ambiguity. So
yes.
I don't when I say ambiguity, I don't mean it's unclear. What I mean is this: it was the same. It was a role model for me for The Babadook, in that if you looked at the film as a woman going nuts,
yeah.
it would hold up on every level.
Yeah.
Or if you looked at it as a ghost story, it would hold up on every level.
Yes.
So that is that requires a lot of thought and a lot of care and consideration. You know, it started, Henry James wanted the same. It was based on The Turn of the Screw, which is his short story. And he applied that same rigor to his story in that you can read it one way or the other.
And I mean, it's it's funny that people have a set idea of what they think, whereas the director, Jack Clayton, which we'll get into, he also was a filmmaker of ambiguity when he was thinking about this film.
Yeah, and it's more, you know, it's to me more elegant, more subtle to have two ideas, two possibilities running concurrently. And it's what makes amazing horror.
For those of you who haven't seen The Innocents, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch The Innocents first, this is your chance. Now let's introduce The Innocents. I want that little music now every time. Written by William Archibald, Truman Capote, and John Mortimer, and directed by Jack Clayton for release in 1961. The Innocent stars Deborah Kerr as Miss Giddens, a woman who gets a job taking care of a wealthy man's niece and nephew on a beautiful country estate. She's told the previous governess, Miss Jessel, died there under mysterious circumstances less than a year before.
Just when I thought I'd got the whole situation settled and everything running smoothly, a confounded woman died. It was all very odd.
Miss Giddens has no experience caring for children, but the uncle really couldn't care less.
He just couldn't give a shit.
He just wants to get the
He's
hell
like, hello,
out of there.
I'm Michael Redgrave. Now go look after this children.
The person whom I engage must solemnly promise to accept full and complete responsibility. She must never trouble me. Never, never. Neither complain, nor appeal, nor write. Simply take the whole thing over and leave me alone.
Miss Giddens meets little Flora and loves her instantly. She's adorable. She strikes up a friendship with the housekeeper as well, Mrs. Gross, before little Miles gets sent home from the boarding school for being a bad influence, which is an understatement, we'll say. At first, it seems impossible that Miles could misbehave as such, although it's very clear that this little boy seems far more mature than 10 as he begins flirting heavily with Miss Giddens.
Yes, it's a little weird.
A little less than innocent way, we'll say.
May I tell you something? Yes, Miles, of course. I think you're far too pretty to be a governess. And I think you're far too young to be such a deceitful flatterer.
Soon, Miss Giddens is very disturbed by the children whispering and keeping secrets with one another while she begins to see the apparitions of a man and woman who look exactly like Miss Jessel and the estate's deceased valet, Peter Quint.
Just now he was staring past me into the house as if he were hunting someone.
Oh, what's he like, miss?
Oh, he had dark, curling hair and the hardest, the coldest eyes.
You see, would you say he was very handsome?
Oh, yes, yes, handsome, handsome and obscene. But I've seen him before. Yes, I know where I've seen him. A picture. There's a picture of him. A miniature in a cracked glass in the attic. I'll show you.
It can't be.
It can't be. You know him.
Quint. Peter Quint, the master's valet.
But you said...
Yes, miss, you see, he's dead.
Mrs. Gross tells Miss Giddens that Quint was abusive to Jessel and that they performed explicit sex acts in front of others, perhaps even the children.
As you do. I mean, it's
still shocking.
Oh my God. How does she describe it? She says,
rooms used by daylight as though they were dark woods.
They're at it.
Yes.
In front of her.
Yeah. Very subtle, but when you realize what she's talking about, you're like, oh. Okay, this is very weird.
Yeah. How you would behave in a forest. Get it, guys?
That's my favorite euphemism for just straight out fucking, you know? Behave as if you were in a forest.
Oh, my God. I know what you mean.
After Quint's accidental death, Jessel drowned herself. Miss Giddens then becomes obsessed with the idea that Miles and Flora's bodies have been inhabited by the two deceased spirits. Miss Giddens vows to save them. One night, she talks with Miles, and he admits to her that he was kicked out of school for frightening the other boys with violence.
Sometimes I hurt things. And sometimes at night, when Everything was dark.
What?
They screamed. The masters heard about it. They said, I frightened the other boys.
Miles suddenly begins cackling and shouting while Quint's visage appears in the window behind him, joining in the laughter. Mm. Miles runs outside. Miss Giddens gets him to yell his name, Quint. Mm. Miles falls to the ground, dead. And Miss Giddens cradles him in a very fucked up ending.
Gives him a big pash on the lips.
Yeah.
And... of film.
Yep. That was a... can you imagine people, like, the lights go down in the theater and everyone's like,
what? But it was intimated in The Turn of the Screw as well, which was written in the 1890s. So that's even more shocking.
It's very risque.
Mm. But I'm so amazed that a film that was made in 61 did that. You know, that they didn't pull back from that. They didn't try and sort of omit that stuff.
I think that some of the best interviews that I've read about this movie come from the cinematographer who also became a director, Freddie Francis.
Yeah, he did Elephant Man.
Exactly. He did The Innocents, and then he did another movie I can't remember. Took a break for 20, 25 years to direct a lot of Hammer horror films.
Yeah.
And then came back and immediately did cinematography for The Elephant Man.
Yeah, which is... exquisite. Unbelievable. And you can see The Innocents and you can see The Elephant Man. You can see, you know, the same person at work.
Yes. And so a lot of his interviews are really great. He knows how to talk about things as a director and as a cinematographer. And so he understood and appreciated everything that Jack Clayton was doing. He said that this was an interesting movie because it's a ghost story where there are no actual ghosts necessarily. He's, you know, like, of course we can see these apparitions necessarily in the window or something, but it's not like a ghost in the way that you would think of a ghost.
Like Ooga Booga sort of, oh, they're there all the time? Is that what you mean?
He said, quote, it's a dark, brooding story that was gently and lovingly handled by Jack Clayton. There were few effects and almost no visuals of ghosts, just the merest hint of them lurking in the shadows in the outside of the old dark house.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of suggestion of those things.
But even when there is a ghost... I'm just thinking the scene with Flora where she loses her shit. Remember where she's like screaming for a good 10 minutes and then gets carted away towards the end of the film.
Yeah.
But where Deborah Carr's character, you know, says, can't you see? Can't you see? And that she's the little girl is just totally freaked out.
Mm-hmm.
So you get the sense that she can't see anything.
It's the reactions, like these really lovely performances of reaction.
Yeah.
And that's something I'm curious, you know, as a director, how you handle, because, I mean, there are people who witness very scary things in your movie, whether it's real life horror or kind of imagined or fantastical horror. And how do you get those kinds of performances of people?
Well, I mean, I was inspired by the children in The Innocents because I think they're extraordinary. And, you know, I think that I don't know how Jack Clayton worked with those kids, but I think that they must have been privy to something of what was going on because it doesn't feel like he's manipulated their reactions to get a performance.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I can't speak to how he did that, but for my money, I made sure that in my films, every actor is in charge. So they know the story fully, they know their part in it and they understand their role and what they have to achieve. So even with little Noah Wiseman, who was 5 in the making of The Babadook, you know, I took him to the zoo and sat him down. We spent the day together and then we got, you know, we'd already got to know each other a bit and I told him the story of The Babadook from his character's perspective.
Yes.
And it's obviously a bit more of a G-rated version. But he was a robust kid, you know, emotionally very intelligent. And I appealed to his compassion for his character.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, can you imagine what it would be like for Sam, you know, to know this thing is real and his mum doesn't believe him.
Yeah.
And he got really upset. He was like, oh, you know, what? That's terrible. And, you know, and I said, so it's his job to save his mum. And I could see him processing this and saying, right, okay, this is really important. And even throughout the rehearsals, his mum, who happened to be a child psychologist, said to me, he's never this focused, And she said to him, you never do your homework at school, you're never this focused. And he said, yeah, but mum, this is important.
Yeah.
So he had a sense of the importance of it.
This child needs some kind of voice or some kind of justice. Yeah. And that's the...
Yeah, and so he knew his role was really important. And I can't abide it when kids are tricked into a performance. Or sometimes directors will trick adults into a performance. And I just think, give them credit. Give them credit for their intelligence and their skill.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the confines of the process of, working with someone who's kind of overseeing things, how to get out of those confines in creative ways, and also some handmade solutions that Freddie Francis came up with on set that I always thought were really ingenious.
Great.
So we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Dave.
Hi, I'm Graham.
And we're two house DJs who have been trapped inside our drum machine.
We love it here, and we'd love if you stopped by and visited us every week on Stop Podcasting Yourself
here on MaximumFun.org.
We're just a couple of doofuses from Canada.
And listen to our show or perish. Stop Podcasting Yourself
on MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Jennifer Kent, and we're talking about The Innocents. Okay, so I mentioned some things that Freddie Francis did on set, and I really want to get into some of that because it is just so cool the way that they made this movie.
So excellent to hear. I didn't know this stuff.
Okay, so he said, quote, from the very early stages of the production, everyone was aware that it was going to be shot in CinemaScope because it was a 20th Century Fox picture. Yeah. They wanted everything at that time because they owned the process, right?
Yeah.
So everyone knew this except Jack. Of course, Jack knew.
You don't need to just tell him the end.
Like, he knew, but he didn't want to think about it because he really didn't want to shoot it in CinemaScope. He was fighting against it all the time, hoping that it would just go away. Given the opportunity, he would have arrived on the morning we started principal photography and said, no, it can't be in CinemaScope.
Wow.
The film was always designed to be shot in black and white because he wanted it to be dark, extremely dark in some scenes, almost claustrophobic, to make it appear that it was extreme darkness. And he felt that he couldn't achieve that atmosphere in color or CinemaScope.
Right.
So it was just a constant problem.
Wow. So what format did he want to shoot it in?
He wanted to do 4:3.
Wow.
So Jack designed the film in Academy ratio, basically 4:3, which was the usual almost square screen. However, I always knew, this is Freddie Francis, I always knew it would be shot in the widescreen process. And for everything we planned, I kept in mind that it would have to be widescreen.
Oh, my God.
Eventually, I persuaded Jack that there was nothing he could do to avoid the inevitable, because if we didn't think scope, then Fox was likely to withdraw. Because Jack had blinkered himself against the eventuality of CinemaScope, I had prepared an alternative to redesigning in a photographic sense the entire production. So Freddie Francis came up with some great ideas.
That is incredible, because I went the opposite. So with The Nightingale, it's not 4:3, it's Academy ratio is, being anally retentive here. It's 1:3:7. So it's slightly less boxy. Slightly more width. But we had to sign a contract saying that we would also do a version in, I don't think they wanted CinemaScope, but I think they needed 16:9.
Yeah.
Just to, make everyone happy.
Yeah.
But what I did secretly was put a lot of shit in frame outside of Academy ratio. So it would be too expensive to create a 16:9 version.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. And we've never been asked to do one anyway. But if we did, it would cost millions of dollars and no one would be able to afford to do that.
Oh, my God.
So note to directors out there, if you want to use a smaller frame, a smaller format.
Yeah.
That's the way to go.
Okay, so here's the thing that Freddie Francis designed for that.
Yeah.
He said, I devised...
Well, he knew it was inevitable, whereas in our case... I knew
you had
that
to
we
fight
would
against
get.
It.
I knew we would get Academy ratio on the screen, but I really did not want, you know, a format is like a character.
Yes.
So I really didn't want a larger format out there. I would never support that film.
Because you don't know, that would probably, that could come out on Blu-ray and you wouldn't have any
choice. Yeah, so we paid no heed to the 16:9 frame. So as long as we were clear in Academy, I was fine.
And your cinematographer was like on board.
Oh, yeah, he was
totally
in on it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, totally.
I like it. So everyone's on the same page.
Yeah, and no one's asked for it anyway. I think when people saw the film, they went, of course, we understand why you've made it in this ratio, so let's forget about.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting as a director to have that dictated, you know, for you. And I think it's amazing, actually, because I think The Innocents, at one point I was watching it again last night and I thought, oh, wow, CinemaScope. That's an interesting choice for this film.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting that it wasn't Jack Clayton's actual choice.
I mean, Fox demanded. There was no way they were going to get around it. Like, they needed the money. But the way that they got around it was that...
It works. It definitely works.
I guess Freddie Francis said, I devised a set of color glass filters which had the effect of fading the picture out toward the edges and concentrating the audience's attention on different sections of the large screen, normally toward the center. There were 12 glass filters and they like each one, you know, had hand colored. He went to two older women, like these 70-year-old women in Windsor, and Kodak had been like, these are the women that you need to hand paint them. And they were hand painted by these older women who just like lovingly like,
oh my God.
Yeah, right?
So they hand painted the outside of the lens.
Yeah. Like,
so that it was sort of...
it darkened everything.
Wow, that's incredible.
Isn't that neat?
That's so amazing.
And then he
ended up
making two additional filters while he was shooting because he had like two spare panes of glass because he wasn't sure exactly what was going to be, what parts they should distort of the frame until they actually got to that point.
Yeah.
But he said, you know, it gave the picture another dimension, almost framing all the action in a cocoon of darkness.
Yeah, wow. I mean, that's the thing. That's so incredible. I thought it was done with lighting because I did notice that, you know, there's a central point and then the rest bleeds out to nothingness.
Yes.
But I thought it was lighting because it's, you know, often happening at night.
Obviously, I mean, not everything in this movie is just filters. The lighting of this was extremely intricate. I mean, aside from there's the story of how Freddie Francis ordered special candles be made because they had to have between 4 and 5 wicks pushed through them because it wasn't creating enough light to make it look as dynamic as he wanted on the screen.
So beautiful.
But he said that a lot of that they had required them to shoot in MOS, so they were shooting without sound and some things. He said, we used a massive number of dimmers on the picture. Dimmers are known as a sound man's nightmare because they are prone to create a great deal of noise when they are turned up and down. So when we did use them, usually during Deborah's wanderings around the old house with candles, we could only shoot the sequence silent and and add the sound effects when required.
Well, that's interesting because that's another beautiful thing about this film is the sound. You know, the sparse use of music. It's not wall-to-wall music. The sound often is very subtly amplified. Like there are some scenes where the birds start off beautifully, but by the end of the scene, they're really grating. And the sound has a spare and sparse quality that's really quite frightening.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. I'm very sound focused, and I didn't pick up that those scenes were shot without sound because I feel it's very organic what's going on.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's beautifully done. The sound design on that film is also very inspirational.
And we should point out that...
And modern horror filmmakers in particular could take note of that sound design.
I mean, lovely that you say that because the uncredited sound designer is actually Daphne Oram, a woman. The use of natural sound to create sympathetic background gives way more to manufactured effects through electronic treatments created by an uncredited Daphne Oram.
Why was she uncredited? That's abysmal.
I don't know. She's co-founder of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. Right. Oram's work first appears while Miss Giddens is walking in the garden with birds singing in the background. The bird song stops abruptly, and as she looks up and sees a figure in a tower of the house, ringing in slowed down tones and oscillations take over the soundtrack. Mm. From this point, electronics are used more frequently in conjunction with sound effects and music to heighten the growing sense of unease and ultimately horror.
Mm. So, wow, that's amazing.
She's weaving it through.
Yeah, with Babadook, the rule was if we absolutely cannot get through this moment without sound, we add music, but only then and then do we add music.
Yeah.
And I feel that with this film too. I feel that the music used, I can't even remember the music. I watched it last night again, but it feels like the music is it's not, as I said, it's not wall to wall. It's just there when it needs to be, and mm-hmm. the sound is given respect—the respect that it deserves in a spooky ghost story.
Oh yeah, I think,
and it's very much from her perspective. The sound, I feel.
Yes.
So when she's, you know, when the birds or when the nature sounds need to be irritating because of what's going on for her, that's when they shift and change.
So Jack Clayton, when he was working on this in conjunction with Daphne and some other folks in the score and the sound, he had become really obsessed with birds.
Yes.
Freddie Francis said, another touch by Jack was the almost constant presence of white doves or pigeons.
Yeah.
Whereas the flies, because it's the sound of the flies had heralded death, these beautiful creatures symbolize life and purity. It was on this picture that Jack began his passion for these birds, and they became the extras in the movie. Mm. As the writer John Mortimer has said, towards the end of his life, he seemed more excited by the triumphs of his homing pigeons. Somehow he acquired them, bred from them, and they changed his life.
Wow. And in his personal life?
In his personal life.
That's amazing.
So on this film, he became so obsessed with them because he loved working with them and loved the sounds that they made in this movie so much that he fell in love.
But they're not always soothing in the film either. That's what's so beautiful about it.
Because they're chaotic sometimes.
Yeah.
And they...
Yeah. And they mirror an anxiety that's going on in Miss Giddens. So it's very interesting.
And this is pre the birds, we should say.
Yeah, yeah. So. But I feel all the nature sounds were used so elegantly and so thoughtfully, but not also a cacophony.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like you must feel this watching it. It's like it's just accenting it so subtly and beautifully.
I mean, so did you approach sound design in The Nightingale the same that you did The Babadook? You know, you're looking for the natural things? Because a lot of that movie is also outside.
Yeah, The Nightingale, I also became obsessed with birds. And
shit! This is
my God! Well, Tasmania is an island. It's a mythic place in a way. It feels it's so removed. There's nothing between Tasmania and the South Pole, and it feels it's got a lot of different birds, a lot of different animals. I really wanted those sounds to be the sounds of the film. So I went, we recorded birds, Tasmanian birds. We recorded Tasmanian devils, which make the most incredible sound.
Can you do an impression of a Tasmanian devil?
Something like that. They're the cutest little animals, and then they open their mouth and you go, oh, shit, and that thing is going to kill me.
Well, then you got to put that shit in there.
We did. And so all the sounds, I will admit there's one koala in there because they also make a terrifying sound.
What are they? I don't have no idea.
I can't remember. It's like, ooh, or something. It's scary, but they don't exist in Tasmania.
Oh.
But then everything else in the film exists only in Tasmania or does exist in Tasmania.
Yeah. The natural world is very important to The Nightingale.
Yeah, and we had Rob McKenzie, who's an Oscar-winning sound designer and normally had worked on his own, which I found weird that no directors had infiltrated his world before. And so I think he initially found me very irritating because I was there. Like, hi, Rob, it's me again. About that bird sound. Can I have a listen? But then I think he, you know, I pushed him to a place that was different to how he was used to working. And yeah. I think he came to really appreciate that. Well, he told me that. Maybe he was lying. But but I feel very proud of the sound in The Nightingale because it's all diegetic sound. So it's just what Claire would hear. Mm-hmm. So we're in her shoes. The only music in the film is her singing or Billy singing, or when she goes a bit nuts, she hears a different arrangement of a song that she sang earlier in the film.
Yeah.
But other than that, there's no score. So I love it when people come up the end and go, I love the score. And they go, well, there wasn't one.
That's interesting.
Doofus. But I don't say that. I just say thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to get into some post-production of editing and some other fun things and the weird many parallels between your films and The Innocents. Okay, we'll be right back.
Hi, I am Lori Kilmartin.
And I'm Jackie Cashin.
Together, we host a podcast called
The Jackie and Lori Show.
We're both stand-up comics. We recently met each other because women weren't allowed to work together on the road or in gigs for a long, long time. And so our friendship has been unfolding on this podcast for a couple of years. Jackie constantly works the road. I write for Conan, and then I work the road in between.
We do a lot of stand-up comedy, and so we celebrate stand-up, and
yes.
We also bitch about it.
We keep it to an hour. We don't have any guests. We somehow find enough to talk about every single week. So find us. You can subscribe to The Jackie and Lori Show at Maximum Fun. .org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, bye.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Jennifer Kent, and we're talking about The Innocents. Okay, can I say, you know, the parallels that I'm seeing both with The Nightingale and with The Babadook and to The Innocents is that we're really looking at the interiority of a woman kind of degrading, but in an outward fashion. We see the kind of outward manifestation of it from this inner turmoil.
Yeah.
And, I mean, is that an obsession for you?
I think what's an obsession for me is really empathy. And I think that film making or films can be a tool of empathy. And what I mean by that is however I can get the audience into the experience of the lead character, which in my case has always been a woman and probably will always be a woman as the lead character, the more we can get inside her skin, the more we will experience the film as we're meant to experience it.
Mm-hmm.
So every aspect of the filmmaking process, I am focused on making it a subjective experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean manipulating an audience to feel a certain way. I just mean attempting to get them into her mind frame.
Yeah, you can not like them if you want to.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, I'm also not interested in creating likable characters, which was, you know, a big thing about the Babadook as well when I was trying to get it financed. But she's not likable. I was like, well, I don't like you either, so, you know.
You too are
unlikable. And you're a human. And I think, you know, flawed characters are essential to make something real mm-hmm. and true. But, yeah, so I think I really appreciate in The Innocents how we are in her skin.
Mm-hmm.
And I see every choice made supporting that.
Yeah.
And so I feel that that's when I look at Jack Clayton's film, I feel a kindred spirit in that way because I understand what he's doing.
I also have to say that Deborah Kerr as an actor really, really ended up playing a lot of governesses or caretakers of some sort. King and I, The Chalk Garden.
Yeah.
This movie, Tea and Sympathy and Bonjour Tristesse and An Affair to Remember even.
She
a teacher.
Yeah, or a nun
yeah.
in Black Narcissus. So she was a very dependable character. It's really smart casting because people recognized her as someone that they could depend on.
Yeah.
So to flip that and to have her as someone maybe who wasn't of sound mind
yeah.
is frightening for an audience who goes, but hang on, that's Deborah Carr. I can trust her. Well, can you? Who knows?
No one knows. And there was a really great, Stephen Mears was writing something for Film Comment a while back, and he said, quote, codependency infuses all of her governess portrayals and is one reason why her creations are miles apart from Julie Andrews' impeccable Mary Poppins or concurrent TV domestics like Shirley Booth's Hazel and Alice from the Brady Bunch. Kerr's nannies need their children perhaps even more than they're needed by them.
Right. Yeah.
There's something longing in her.
Yeah.
And something that
a fragility.
Quality about it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That's something that I was really excited that you tapped into with Essie Davis, I think, that ability to...
Yeah. I mean, with Essie, Essie's a dear friend. She's one of my best friends. And we went through drama school together. And I have a lot of love. We, you know, we love each other and trust each other. But the thing about Essie was actually finding that because... she has a lot of strength.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's formidable as a person. And I wanted to peel off a bit of that.
Yeah. Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries, for instance, Americans are very familiar. She's a very strong, strong kind of, you know, character who just cannot be broken.
Yeah. And that's Essie. I mean, that's her. I don't mean that Miss Fisher is her, but I mean she sits in a place that's very strong and very comfortable in her strength. But what I needed was to access the more fragile being that was Amelia for the first half of the film. And then when we got to the second half, was just letting her let it rip.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she's a wonderful actress. So it's often about, as a director, working with what you have, but also eliciting something new for an actor to lean into. And in Essie, you know, in some other, in another actress, it could have been having to push them to a place of strength. But for Essie, the first half of the film, we had to tone it down. She actually auditioned for the role, and that wasn't because I needed to know if she could act, but I needed to know.
Oh, you just wanted to put her on a lower pedestal?
Yeah,
and
I just wanted
like,
to
humiliate
her, basically. No, I wanted to make sure that we could, because we're such good friends, I wanted to make sure that we could relate as director and actor.
Yeah.
So it was really a test for her to see if she wanted that process as much as whether I could step into that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And to her credit, she's such an extraordinary professional that immediately she wanted to be directed.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was never an issue. It was such a joyous... I love actors. I mean, you know, the actors on Nightingale saved me because it was a very tough film to make. It was a heartbreaking film to make.
Your lead actress...
Aisling.
Oh, my God.
Franchosi.
Yeah.
Yeah. She is... and Baker Lee Ganimbar, who plays Billy... Both of them were constantly bringing the best that they had, which was a lot, to the table. And, you know, it's such a tough story. The history of my country is so hard, but it's something that we all felt needed to be told. And to step into the wilderness every day with that caliber of actor, it was just a joy. Mm-hmm. And they really did save me. From the material. And by that, I mean save me from being too heartbroken to continue.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a sad story in many respects, but just so, so evocative. Just so, there's so many emotions that you're feeling as you're watching it.
Yeah.
But we were talking earlier about the kind of default language that people talk about with the Nightingale is brutal.
Mm. I mean, I've never experienced, I'm quite scared of Q&As now because I don't know what I'm going to encounter.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, it's deeply, some responses have hurt me because they've been personal.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you work so hard to tell a story of light and love in dark times, it takes a lot from you as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And then to encounter the film being misunderstood and to be labelled as, you know, a pornographer or, I mean, it all started in Venice, you know, a journalist called out, shame on you, whore, you're disgusting. And which at the time I thought, he's just being Italian, it's fine. He's just being an Italian dude. And I found it funny. But I have to say, as the process has gone on, I've witnessed maybe not as overt an antagonism as that, but I have received a lot of hate's maybe too strong a word, but agitation. Mm-hmm. And I've really thought deeply about it. And I think that the film, I feel ultimately I have to take that as a compliment, as mm-hmm. weird as it may sound, because I think the film really invites people to feel what Claire is feeling. Mm-hmm. And it's not pleasant. It's not pleasant when we feel what Billy feels either. But I think it's important. This goes back to this idea of empathy, which mm-hmm. I think is fast disappearing in our world. I find it much more disturbing that we can watch such violent cinema as entertainment mm-hmm. and not feel a damn thing.
Yeah.
And so if people sit through this film and at the end they feel wrecked and they feel affected, what would it be just to sit with those feelings for an hour afterwards and not blame the director for telling the story?
For making me feel this way. Yeah. Why did you make me feel this way,
well,
Jennifer?
because it's my job to bring light to the darkness. That's my job. And I'm not a nihilist. I'm a pacifist. I care deeply about the human condition. And
there's
and,
another director, Michael Haneke, gets the same. And he's,
yeah, well, it's funny you should mention him because I was talking to lovely Laura from IFC before about the expression on Michael Haneke's face when he's interviewed by journalists. He has this sort of tired resignation. And I used to think, what's his problem? And now I know what that look, I know that look from the inside.
Maybe now you know why Jack Clayton got really into birds. I'm just going
to
say it.
Well, I have to say I love plants. I really love plants. I love being in my garden because plants don't tell you that you're an asshole. I love my cat. I love being in nature. But yeah, I think it's interesting. I think in a world where we're more and more medicated and more anesthetized to the problems of others and our default position is to turn away. Mm-hmm. I can't turn away. You know, it's this Buddhist idea of opening your heart to the suffering of the world and let it in and see how it feels. It doesn't feel good, but then can we transform that to love, compassion, kindness? And if you really stick with the film and you look at it on a subtle level, there's love running all the way through The Nightingale. And that is why I made it.
I wanted to thank you so much for coming and talking to me today about this film and your movie. And we should tell people that The Nightingale comes out August 2nd.
Yeah.
And that's in New York and Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And then it will be opening wider to more cities after that. So you'll just have to check and see if you're not in New York and Los Angeles, but definitely check it out August 2nd.
And I encourage people to go along, you know, opening weekend if they can because of the way film works now.
Yeah, you really have to. We've seen that with a number of our guests who made these incredible films, and people were like, "Oh, I'll just wait till VOD." But I'm sorry,
No way.
If you've got access to a theater and you can swing it, you know,
see
have
it.
That experience.
I mean,
and
the thing about The Nightingale, I think, is it is a big screen film to see the nature in that film. A lot of it, which has never been on screen before, we went into the wilderness in Tasmania, and those areas have not been filmed. And I think to see that on a big screen is something else.
Yeah.
And it'll hit you more.
Also, you've just learned about all the sound design, and that's always better in a theater.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks, April. You're welcome.
And thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. Here's one from E. Marie. They say, "I love this podcast. I feel it was made just for me. Love April Wolf. Love the logo. The Switchblade Sister wants a t-shirt to shout it out to the world." I, too, would like a t-shirt, E. Marie. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at Switchblade Pod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
Leave me alone.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.